Thank you very much, David, for this very nice introduction. Indeed, as you said, the title is very similar to the title of the book. What I'm presenting is one of the chapters of the book, which is forthcoming, but I'm still tinkering with it, still trying to get it in proper shape. So any feedback on the paper will be extremely useful in getting that done as well. The challenge this morning for me was to cut down a 13,000 word chapter into a 7,000 word paper. Partly because of that, I will do it the very old-fashioned way and actually just read. Otherwise, I will not even be able to get through half of the chapter. The reduced version of this chapter. So I'll just start as such. In April 2009, I took part in a three-day Dawat, or proselytizing tour of the Tablighi Jamaat, a conservative Islamic piety movement which has firmly established itself in Kyrgyzstan since the 1990s. During one afternoon, our fellowship, or Jamaat, was seated around a low table in the courtyard behind the mosque, eating a warm lunch. We were talking about spiritual affairs when Maksat, who was on his third Dawat, asked, quote, "Is it true what they say, that when you go to heaven there will be 1,200 virgins waiting?" Right. Nur Islam, the Amir or leader of our fellowship, responded, "There will be many virgins, and what is more, every one of those virgins will be more beautiful than the most beautiful woman you have ever seen in your life. And your wife, she will be the most gorgeous one of all." Around the table, tongues were clicking. Some of the men expressed looks of affirmation, others of anticipation. Not wishing to confront what to me came across as sexism, yet unable to listen quietly, I interjected, "How is it even possible? I mean, which man would be able to satisfy so many women?" It turned out to be a naive question. Nur Islam responded with a serious demeanor, "Well, you should understand that in heaven your manly powers will be multiplied as well." Sex and women were recurrent topics of conversation among participants in Dawat, and this particular episode continues to stand out when I think of the three Dawats in which I participated. One reason for its memorable nature is that the topic made me feel uncomfortable, as I was unable to join in the fascination. Another reason was the seriousness and detail with which the virgin story was discussed among the men. Indeed, what fascinated me most was that these ideas momentarily attained a level of reality that I had not expected. I was surprised not only because of my own biases, but also because most of my acquaintances in Kyrgyzstan had only ever spoken of the virgins as a kind of a joke, if at all. The fantasy did, however, connect with locally widespread ideas and practices. While for young men, young and married women, the ideal of chastity is held up high, it is commonly accepted and expected that married men have as many girlfriends as their financial and social position allows. The reality of the virgins did not emerge out of thin air, but was richly connected to ideas of masculinity, sexuality, and worldly success. So this paper focuses on Tablighi techniques to make and keep ideas relevant, believable, and embodied. And although we tend to think of ideologies as configurations of ideas, the ideas that make up ideologies do not necessarily travel as a package. They often move in fragments and bits. New ideologies are rarely accepted at once. Their internalization can be a haphazard process, characterized by intensification, deflation, and partial evaporation. That is, their trajectories are endowed with a pulsating quality. This tends to be particularly visible when ideologies are new, that is, when they are encountered as new in adulthood instead of being acquired through upbringing and socialization from an early age onwards. The external observer does not usually notice this pulsating quality, and especially when access is limited to one moment in time, this may result in depictions of belief and unbelief as unfixed states. By contrast, movements such as the Tablighi Jamaat are cognizant of the pulsating quality of faith and have devised their own strategies to combat the dissipation of conviction. Dawat is their central and energizing practice. Ideally, Tablighis go on Dawat for one evening a week, three consecutive days each month, a 40-day Dawat each year, and 4 month davat once in a lifetime. On 3 day davats, and those were the most, that was the most common form in Kyrgyzstan, participants traveled to a mosque other than their own in groups of 6 to 10 men. During these davats, the three aspects of traveling, male bonding, and storytelling produce an effect of intensification, which allows access to levels of experience that tend to remain untouched in everyday life. Hence, though davat literally means invitation and in the Tablighi context can be translated as a proselytizing tour, the spiritual effect is foremost on the davatchis themselves instead of the people they invite to follow the same path. For the travelers, davat offers an opportunity to learn, to translate loosely held ideas into an Islamic vocabulary, and to consolidate these in practice and routine. The embodied truth that is thereby produced does not, however, necessarily last long after the davatchis return home. Davatchis in Kyrgyzstan. The historical trajectory of the Tablighi Jamaat has often been described. Starting from its origins in northern India in the 1920s, its increasingly transnational profile from the 1950s onwards, to becoming one of the largest Islamic piety or renewal movements by the late 20th century. Close-up analysis of the Tablighi Jamaat tend to be frustrated by the movement's public silence. It avoids making public statements and discourages its adherents from talking to journalists. In Kyrgyzstan, this low profile meant that many participants were unaware of the name Tablighi Jamaat when they first became involved. The term more commonly used by both insiders and outsiders was davachi, which refers to people who go on davat. Ignorance of the name has nothing to do with secrecy, but everything with organizational features. Due to the Tablighi decentralized structure and the emphasis on engagement rather than affiliation, the official name is not all that relevant. Davat first appeared in Kyrgyzstan in 1992, when Tablighis from Pakistan traveled to the country. In the early years, the movement remained small and was barely noticed, but this started to change around the turn of the millennium. Due to the absence of formal membership, it's not possible to provide precise numbers, but by 2007, an estimated 10,000 people were involved in Tablighi activities. In a country with 4 to 5 million people, this means that davatchis became a familiar sight throughout the country. Explaining this relative success is not my aim here, but discussing the movement's advance in the region will allow me to kickstart an exploration of the central theme, how commitment and conviction are temporarily produced. The Tablighi advance in Central Asia has been uneven, making significant inroads into Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, but failing to do so in Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. Maybe unsurprising given that the Tablighi Jamaat is banned as an extremist group in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan. Nevertheless, the pattern is replicated within Kyrgyzstan itself in the sense that Uzbeks, who make up a sizable 12% of the population, hardly take part in Tablighi activities. And this is counterintuitive because Uzbeks are locally depicted as more religious than Kyrgyz, in that they more strictly observe the pillars of Islam. Success among the quote-unquote less religious is also geographically visible in Kyrgyzstan, where the Tablighis have attracted more participants in the locally depicted secular north than the Islamic south of the country. A local Tablighi scholar reflected on these patterns as follows. Dawat used to be active, and I'm quoting him here, Dawat used to be active in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan in the 1990s, but the Tablighis there made a mistake. They became involved in politics, while our position needs to be absolutely apolitical. So then Alat took Dawat away from these countries. There's another thing. Uzbeks have traditionally paid more attention to religious education, to going to the mosque, etc. And once you have gone down one path, it is very difficult to return and start anew. The Kyrgyz were different. They were like a blank slate. Another geographic pattern is that the Tablighi Jamaat has a larger following in urban than in rural areas. A possible reason is that Dawat offers a form of male bonding that finds a real need in post-Soviet urban contexts. And several Dawatchis told me that through Dawat, they reconnected with former school friends. The kind of outdoor traveling of Dawat is also more likely to attract urban than rural young men. Almost all urban travelers, especially those aged 30 and up, commented that Dawat reminded them of the Soviet pioneer and Komsomol camps, when they would leave the city to spend time in nature with only the most basic facilities available. If the Soviet legacy provides clues for why the Tablighis find resonance among Kyrgyz urban men, this legacy also clarifies why they fail to produce the same response among urban men. Among urban women. In short, Tablighi ideas of proper gender behavior do not translate easily to the post-Soviet Kyrgyz context. The spouse of a Dawatchi, university-educated spouse, expressed her view to me in a dismissive tone of voice. Well, never will I join them. The idea of a woman is to be submissive, to serve her husband, and to stay home with the children. Such ideas do not only clash with 70 years of Soviet discourse on female emancipation, but also with the fact that most Kyrgyz urban women have jobs outside the domestic sphere. To self-declared modern women, the increasingly public presence of conservative, textually-oriented Islamic movements is worrisome. The perspective of my male Tablighi acquaintances on this issue was captured best in a joke that circulated among them. Quote, "The largest obstacle to Dawat in Kyrgyzstan is Kyrgyz women." It is not only among educated women that negative opinions about Tablighis can be found. The same was true for many men and women who described themselves as, quote-unquote, not religious. One of my acquaintances told me, quote, "They dress like fanatics, and really, it is impossible to have a normal conversation with them. They only talk about religion, religion, religion." The director of the Kyrgyz Committee of Religious Affairs added his own personal view to his ready-made stump speech about respecting religious freedom when I interviewed him in 2011. You know, the Kyrgyz, and I'm quoting him here, you know, Kyrgyz people are horse riders. When a boy is born, the first thing he learns is to ride a horse. And horse riders need to wear trousers. This is deeply ingrained in our culture. We were the ones who introduced trousers to Europe. And now these Tablighis import dressing coats from Pakistan, walking around in long robes. This is completely alien to our people. The emphasis on garments illustrates that the Tablighi advance is threatening to notions of Kyrgyz culture precisely by reconfiguring cultural elements into religious ones. When it came to the Tablighis, ambivalent attitudes prevailed. The Tablighis non-Kyrgyz appearance is thoroughly disliked by many, while as Muslims they are treated with respect. They encounter distrust among secular and religious authorities, but also have multiple connections within the establishment. Such ambivalence also bespeaks the relationship between the Tablighis and the law. The letter of a new anti-proselytism law of 2009 implied that the Tablighi practice of gasht, in which Dawatchis go from door to door to invite people to the mosque, would henceforth be illegal. However, the Dawatchis with whom I discussed the issue were untroubled by this law, or as one of them put it, quote, "This law is intended to restrict proselytization by Jehovah Witnesses. It's different for us because this is a Muslim country." Again, this does not mean that people generally welcome the Tablighis, but rather that their activities are condoned. When asked, the deputy director of the State Committee of Religious Affairs admitted that the law is not enforced in the case of the Tablighis, but he justified this by saying that anyway the population largely rejects them. Quote, "When they knock on people's doors, then the usual response is, 'Be gone.' The Tablighis are, to borrow a famous phrase from Turner, neither here nor there. They are betwixt and between the positions arrayed by law, custom, convention, and ceremonial. They are Muslim, but of a different kind. They look foreign, but most Tablighis are Kyrgyz. Their message is both attractive and repulsive. The emphasis on learning through doing and the sense of fraternity has appealed to a significant group. Their mode of conduct and theology are reprehensible to many others." This liminal position generates an aura of exclusivity and sense of purpose, lending their mission importance and uniqueness. It also contributes to the intensity of spiritual experience, as Turner intimated when he wrote about the blend of loneliness and sacredness, of homogeneity and comradeship that often arises in conditions of liminality. These characteristics are applicable to the movement as a whole, but the temporal dimension, the moment in and out of time, reveals itself particularly clearly in the practice of Dawat, in the section called The Root There. After the Friday prayers in August 2009, approximately 25 men gathered at the mosque in a Bishkek neighborhood. Bishkek is the capital of Kyrgyzstan. It was one of four mosques in Bishkek serving as sending points for Dawat. Several men were wearing the white robe that make Tablighis instantly recognizable, though the majority was dressed in everyday clothes. Most of the men sported beards, or had started growing them, an indicator of prolonged involvement. During the next hours, more men arrived until at 4 p.m. the jamaats, or fellowships, needed to be formed. This was first done informally, after which then two coordinators ensured that all fellowships had a proper composition. They moved several men around so as to obtain a good spread of age and experience in each jamaat, and to ensure that the travelers would be able to communicate effectively with each other, either in Kyrgyz or Russian. After the members of our jamaat had agreed to contribute 100 som, or $2 each, our Amir made a phone call to the head office situated elsewhere in Bishkek and which coordinates the travel destinations. The group's destinations are decided on the basis of the collected sum of money, the availability of a vehicle, and on making sure that all villages and urban neighborhoods are more or less evenly visited by Tablighis. Our fellowship had a car to its disposal, and we found ourselves being sent to a village located 30 kilometers west of Bishkek. When getting ready to depart, everyone turned off their mobile phones. Dawatchis are expected to sever all contacts with friends and relatives for the duration of Dawat. From here on, the Dawatchis submit themselves to the leadership of the Amir. Despite my skepticism, it turned out that the three-door Toyota car seats seven grown men. Packed together, with one of us repeating Zikr, or Remembrance of God, others exchanging stories and anecdotes from their previous Dawats, and me listening to it all with my cheek pressed against the window, we reached our destination 1 hour later. The mosque was a transformed Soviet house of culture, Dom Kulturi, an inversion of the early Soviet practice to turn mosques into barns, sheds, and houses of culture. Both then and now, the buildings continue to exude the atmosphere of their previous incarnations. If mosques turned sheds had preserved an aura that invited respect and care, this house of culture turned mosque had not entirely shed its Soviet past either, its dilapidated condition indicating the villagers' indifference. Not long after our arrival, the local imam appeared. He agreed to us staying in the mosque and promised to lead the two evening prayers. The route there set in motion a process of detachment and separation from everyday life that allows for the formation of what Turner would have called communitas, a generalized social bond of equal individuals who submit together to the general authority of ritual elders. These liminal aspects are core features of Dawat. To quote Massoud, Dawat is travel both in the sense of migration and withdrawal, in which one temporarily migrates from dunya, or worldly pursuits, to din, or religious concerns. The temporal and social conventions that govern everyday life are suspended during this period. During the 3 days of Dawat, the men are not supposed to leave the mosque and its courtyard, except when authorized to do so by the Amir. The rhythm and pace of life is altered, with only the prayer times remaining the same. There are time slots for going on gasht, to invite people to the mosque, for studying, for instructions about proper conduct, and for preparing food. Most of these activities are loosely structured and leave much time for individual prayer, conversation, and resting. The men clearly valued being able to rest from their demanding ordinary lives. They took naps during the day, carried out their assigned tasks at a relaxed pace, and several compared being on Dawat to being on holidays. The plan for the day is decided at a meeting or council each morning. during which the Amir assigns tasks and roles to the Dawachis. Assignments take into consideration level of experience and religious knowledge. For example, the bayan or sermon after the midday prayers is given by the more experienced Dawachis, while novices are asked to repeat the zikr for the benefit of the entire Dawat. All travelers, except those who are very old, rotate in being kuzmat or helper, charged with preparing food during one of the 3 days, tasks that in everyday life are considered female ones. Another traveler acts as the treasurer, taking responsibility for the necessary purchases related to transportation and food. During study sessions, the more experienced Dawachis teach novices the pronunciation of surahs and explain the 6 basic tenets of the tabligh. These leveling techniques produce a sense of inclusion, equality, and companionship. The Dawachis cooperate in the basic activities of food preparation, engage as teachers and students, and learn intimate details about each other while sleeping together in one room and washing themselves side by side. Maqsad stressed these aspects while we were smoking a cigarette just outside the mosque territory. Right. For me, this is like the lager, the camp. When you arrive at the mosque, you never know what to expect. You need to make do with the few available things. We buy some basic food and that's it. And yet, nowhere does food taste as good as on Dawat. To stick with Turner's vocabulary, it describes egalitarian and pre-structural bonds facilitated the production of commitment and the embodiment of knowledge. But what gave it coherence and direction was the liminal experience, the temporal and spatial dimensions of Dawat fenced it off from ordinary life, while the tensions with the outside world contributed to a sense of exclusivity and purpose. Beyond that, Dawat, in its literal meaning of invitation, is all about straddling this boundary between inside and outside, which is revealed with particular clarity in the practice of Gasht. So Gasht refers to the making of rounds through the village in a small group consisting of a leader, a speaker, and a guide from the locality, going from door to door to invite men to come to the mosque. This practice of walking is aimed outwardly at drawing other people to Islam, but it is also an exercise in being a good Muslim. Although Rashid Sultanovic had never been on Dawat before, during his first Gasht he was made speaker. At first he stumbled over his words, but using suggestions from the others, he had his message more or less ready when approaching the 5th house. Quote, "Good afternoon, I am Rashid Sultanovic, and with me are my brothers from Bishkek. As you know, it is very important to pray regularly and to follow the Prophet's way. Therefore, we have come to invite you to the mosque to listen to the bayan, or sermon." Such encounters are often unsuccessful in the conventional sense. Only in a few of the encounters that are observed was the invitation accepted and followed up by the invitee actually showing up at the mosque. The far more common response was for the addressee to wait until the speaker had finished, to then either briskly express disinterest or politely decline the invitation. Such negative and evasive responses were not seen as problematic by the Dawachi. According to the Tablighi Code, and I quote Masood here, the duty of the preacher ends with the communication of the message. Moreover, unsuccessful attempts nevertheless had their own significance for the Dawachis, as the following example shows. After having left the mosque with our 4-person Gasht, we were walking through the lush village street. Rashid and the guide were in front, with me and Amir Sayyid following in the 2nd row. Sayyid was marveling at the trees and explained how each tree, each twig, and even each of the thousands of leaves had been individually shaped. He explained everything around us has its purpose, its meanings, all willed by Allah, end of quote. He continued by telling me and the others, quote, "When you are on Gasht, you are making traces through the village, which are like the footsteps of angels. What we are doing is to spin a web of trails that have positive energy and can be picked up by those who come after us," end of quote. In this spiritually charged environment, the footsteps and trails woven by the Dawachis were seen as having the potential to transform the place. in a world that is saturated with invisible, in a world that is saturated with the visible and invisible signs of the sacred, and that is brimming with divine purpose, failure as such does not exist. To briefly recapitulate the argument so far, I've suggested that the intensification effect derives from the internal sharing for which the ingredients are offered by Dalat. This intensity also relies on a sense of exclusivity produced through an external facing, as illustrated by the negative and ambivalent encounters during the gasht or village walks. The walks also show the importance of making the experiences meaningful, and storytelling plays an essential role in this. Indeed, what pervades all Dawat activities are stories, anecdotes from previous Dawats, religious messages, and interpretations of what is happening. The stories energize the Dawachis, invigorating their experience and animating the landscape. Enchanting stories. A Tablighi acquaintance who accompanied me on several interviews stopped me with a laugh. As you see, it's not easy to interview Dawachis. They talk too much. Most of my questions remained indeed unanswered, but listening to their stories was all the more revealing. So after having joined his acquaintance on several Dawats, he told others, quote, "His approach to research is a bit unconventional. He rarely asks questions. He just listens to what people have to say." Stories are essential for meaningful living. In his book about Serbia in the early 1990s, van der Poort writes that he was struck by everyone's complete reliance on a story that can give meaning, direction, and purpose to aspects of life. He refers to this as verhaal de werkelijkheid, which a Dutch term which is both narrated and narrating reality, and thereby suggests the inseparability between the world and experience. In other words, stories do much more than reflect the world. They also shape lived reality, and do so by engaging the listener as well as the speaker. Willislev suggests that stories can be a magical tool for humanizing hunters, and according to Harding, it is through talking and telling stories that evangelical Baptists convert or others. Stories are an important part of what constitutes experience, and they are tools for convincing others and self of what is true, important, or right. In the case of the Tablighi, stories were important venues by which Dawat success was produced. Gaboriau writes that Tablighi literature, quote, "is always anxious to proclaim that the preaching tours obtained wonderful results." Right. Or as Amir Nur Islam put it to our fellowship, "during Dawat, one should talk only about religion and focus on the positive, rather than allow Satan-inspired negativity." Barbara Metcalf stresses the centrality of stories for the Tablighi movement, which engage the listener not only intellectually, but also emotionally, and that aim to achieve experiential, not intellectual, understanding. This section tries to understand how, through stories, such emotional connections and experiential understandings are produced. According to Geertz, there are at least three points where chaos, a tumult of events which lack not just interpretations but interpretability, threatens to break in upon man. His three points, or limits, are those pertaining to the mind, the body, and the soul, or in his words, at the limits of his analytical capacities, at the limits of his powers of endurance, and at the limits of his moral insight. These limits, which are obviously intertwined, also surfaced in stories told by Tablighis. The limits of analytic capacity resonated in stories that conveyed awe about the creation and the occurrence of miracles. The limits of power and endurance, referring specifically to the body, were revealed in stories about addiction and sex. And the key question about moral insight in 2010 concerned an episode of violence between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks that left everyone shocked. The stories, as I aim to show, reflect and shape reality, but ultimately point beyond narrated reality to that which cannot be said, to the really real. Awe. Quote, Do you know that Captain Jacques Cousteau accepted Islam? On his sea journeys, he discovered that salt and sweet water do not mix. And when he found out that this is exactly how it is written in the Quran, he immediately accepted Islam. Maksud mentioned this during our Dawat, but he was not the first to tell me the story. Many practicing Muslims in Kyrgyzstan, and also actually in Georgia, had told me about Captain Cousteau's instantaneous conversion upon receiving proof of the scientific validity of the Quran. One reason for the captain to be mentioned in conversations was surely because the story of this respectable and famous European television scientist might also inspire me to convert. Beyond this, the fascination with Cousteau reflected the desire to bolster religious authority with scientific means. In similar fashion, newly practicing Muslims in Kyrgyzstan regularly cited the health benefits of regular prayer as comparable to physical exercise and talked about participating in the Ramadan as a detox of sorts. For Muslims who had lived with the truth of scientific atheism, such rationalizations had legitimizing power, meanwhile demonstrating an elective affinity between the teachings of Soviet ethics and Islam. In this post-atheist environment, the discoveries of a Western television scientist had tremendous appeal. If in these examples it appeared to be science rather than religion that held supreme authority, then this was only so because the involved Dawachis had not yet fully understood or internalized the Tablighi message that science is ultimately powerless, as suggested not only by Cousteau's conversion, but also the following example. On the second day of Dawat, Kanat was assigned the task to give the bayan or sermon after the afternoon prayers. He decided to speak about the universe and its perplexing complexity. He was understandably nervous, but told me and himself that he shouldn't be, because those who deliver a bayan receive divine assistance. Kanat's speech was a soft-spoken whirlwind of information, in which he took the audience from the tiniest particles, atoms and electrons, to the galaxy of planets, stars and Milky Ways. The lecture was effective because of Kanat's calm and trust-inspiring manner of speaking and his known position as a doctor of science, which accentuated his claim that not even scientists understand the working of the universe and that they are equally marveled by the fact that the universe displays such an amazing harmony. "Think about it," he stressed. "Everything in this world and beyond is willed by Allah. All is part of his plan." The references to science resonated with post-Soviet sensibilities and intended to demonstrate Islam's superiority. Kanat's insistence that scientists are equally baffled by the complexity of the micro and macro cosmos and the alleged conversion of television scientist Cousteau exemplified this. They conform to the following logic. The limitations of science produce awe for the creation, thereby demonstrating God's omnipotence. Importantly, this omnipotence manifests itself all around us, ready to see for those who pay attention, as the following example illustrates. One afternoon, we were seated in the central mosque of Bishkek with six Dawachis, listening to the consultations of one of the alims, or Islamic scholars. He reached for his smartphone and showed a picture of clouds that form the name Allah in Arabic. Quote, "You see, God makes himself known to us all the time. We just need to pay attention." We spent the next 30 minutes watching a series of videos that demonstrated divine power, including one featuring a girl whose tears turned into crystals and one of a snake that slithered out of a grave after a funeral had ended. The gathered men clicked tongues in amazement at these proofs of divine power. An additional example was a video of the central mosque in Mecca at night, when at a certain point the entire mosque was lighted up. The alim explained that this was not due to artificial lighting, but due to the energy released by prayer, and he marveled at the possibilities of technology. Quote, "Sometimes we are not able to see clearly with our eyes, but the camera will nevertheless record it." The videos produced a momentary awe factor, powerfully evoking divine power. And yet, they could easily backfire. One Dawachi told me afterwards, quote, "There are many fakes amongst these videos, but it wouldn't have been right for me to challenge the Alim." Desire. The invocation of science and its limitations was attractive, but remained at some distance from everyday concerns and lacked the kind of emotive energy evident in stories about sex, such as the following one, which was shared during one of the davats I took part in. Quote, "In paradise, I will have a racing car and drive 500,000 kilometers an hour, and I won't even have to fear an accident." Amir Sayyid was narrating not his own, but his friend's imagination of paradise, which included one particularly poignant one. Quote, "In paradise, the most beautiful virgins will desire to be with me. So you know what I will do? I will have them play football with each other, and I will make love to the ones who score a goal." These fantasies, even in this second-hand rendering, were able to captivate the audience of Dawachis. According to Sayyid, whenever his friend would tell those stories, even the Aksakals, which means greybeards, would all listen attentively. To be sure, not all fantasies were as promiscuous as this one. During another Dawat, Amir Nur Islam explained to us that in paradise, quote, "the heart of your wife will exclaim your name with every beat." This combination of pure devotion and loyalty was particularly attractive because, the Amir continued, one's wife, quote, "will be 1,000 times more beautiful in paradise than she is in this world." It is impossible to determine with certainty the extent to which such stories were accepted as true by the Dawachis. Some appear to take them for the truth. Others may have hoped that they were true, or were simply intrigued by the thought of it all. But it was also clear that being on Dawat intensified their experienced reality. The Dawachis were a meal-only company where they had to improvise and fend for themselves, that is, where they were able to be men and feel like men. It is in that context that the stories and fantasies were narrated and listened to with a greater level of intensity than they would have outside of the Dawat context. An important question is why these stories were so attractive to these men, beyond the possibility that men in general are enticed by prospects of limitless sex and enhanced virility. What was significant was that my acquaintances' experiences compared rather poorly with the presented visions of sex and masculinity. In fact, many of the Dawachis in the Jamaat had difficulties in their relationships with women. Rashid Sultanovich had been kicked out by his wife 2 years earlier, before he became involved in Dawat, after which he had lived in the shell of a house at the outskirts of Bishkek without water or heating. My smoking buddy, Maksat, told me about the throbbing headaches that his wife caused in him, and he repeatedly lamented her nagging and constant criticism of his inability to financially provide for his family. And Kanat commented that Dawat had complicated his marriage, and he talked about his dream to marry a real Muslim girl instead of having an independent wife with her own career. It's against this background that the significance of stories about women and sex becomes evident. The stories express the hope that through Dawat, the men would solve some of their relational and marital problems. Success stories were actively shared, such as the following one. Quote, "My wife would always scold me, but once I started to go on Dawat regularly, she became much softer. One time when I returned from Dawat, I entered the house and she asked me, 'Are you hungry, my dear? Just sit down, I will prepare food for you.'" In late June 2010, a week after the 3-day conflict between Kyrgyz and Uzbeks had left its deadly and destructive traces in southern Kyrgyzstan, in which hundreds of people were killed and tens of thousands of people fled the country into Uzbekistan, people were trying to grasp what had happened. Dawachis in Bishkek were no different. Like others, they wanted to understand why these events were happening. Seated in the mosque, Ali Mohammed was asked by one of the gathered men, quote, "How is it possible that this is happening in Kyrgyzstan, given that Dawat is more active here than in neighboring countries?" The question was troubling because it seemed to contradict the shared notion that when you give to Allah, you will receive back manifold. Ali Muhammad had his answer ready. Quote, "Think of how we relate to children. Imagine that you are watching children at a playground. If someone else's child misbehaves, you won't be concerned. You will think that's their problem, not mine. But surely you won't be that complacent when one of your own children is misbehaving. You will reprimand them and punish them." He paused, looked around as if to make sure that everyone had understood the message, and then added, "And there's more to it. You know, the places where Dawat is strong, those are also the places where Satan tries to fight back." Judging from the responses, this explanation managed to convince. And yet the logic could be bent in multiple directions. A few days before listening to Ali Muhammad, I overheard another experienced Dawaji, addressed with the title Kudama, who offered a radically different interpretation. He was talking about Uzgan, a town which was infamous for the eruption of ethnic violence in the 1990s, but where, contrary to expectations, everything remained calm in 2010 when violence ravaged nearby cities. This miraculous absence of violence, he explained, was because Dawat had been more active in Uzgan than in other towns in the south. It was proof that Allah protects those who go on Dawat. While Alim interpreted the violence as reflecting a father punishing his beloved children, or because of Satan's countermoves, this other explanation suggested that Allah's children were spared because they had been more active in Dawat. The flexibility of Tablighi, or other religious logic, makes it a useful vehicle for making crisis understandable and digestible. Any event could be interpreted as either a gift or punishment by Allah, or alternatively, as the work of Satan. Simultaneously, this flexibility also constituted the weakness of the logic, and it was dependent on not asking too many questions. As Sayyid put it, quote, "It is wrong to question everything. What counts is how you act, how many zikrs, remembrances of God, you say, and how regularly you pray. That's much more important than knowing the answers. Reading surahs is good, but if you start adding up and comparing all the interpretations, your head starts spinning." For Sayyid, the response to heads that are spinning would be acceptance, which is accomplished during the lot and contributes to the intensity of experience, but it is not necessarily of a permanent nature. The route back. After three nights and three days, the Dawat fellowships return to their ascending mosque. This final part of Dawat is meant to provide further spiritual food that will carry the travelers to their next three-day Dawat, in principle 1 month later. It is also the moment when inquiries are made about intentions to go on a 40-day Dawat. On two occasions at which I was present, this final briefing had an energizing or at least a consolidating effect. The travelers narrated how Dawat had strengthened their relationship with God and how it had provided them with new knowledge. Several of the travelers expressed an intention to go on the 40-day Dawat, and travelers who had befriended each other agreed on the date for their next 3-day Dawat. The August Dawat, which has formed the basis of my earlier descriptions, however, had an ending that I had not anticipated. We arrived at the mosque exactly at 4 p.m. and sat down on the carpets outside in the open air. The coordinators who debriefed our fellowship asked each of us to reflect on our experiences. The first one to respond was Kanat. He stayed in line with etiquette when commenting that his Dawat had strengthened his commitment. He mentioned that during the previous 3 days, he had witnessed the power of Dawat. To sustain this claim, he mentioned that after we had made a request for food, the villagers had come out to give us food, and that our prayers for making the gasht successful had resulted in several villagers coming to listen to the sermon. In response, Kanat received the straightforward advice to improve his regularity in prayer and in Dawat. Several others followed, but then the positive flow was interrupted by Adil, who reported, quote, "I understand everything, but my heart remains closed. It is as if it is blocked. Something just doesn't allow it to change." Perhaps his honesty was unexpected. because the coordinator struggled to give satisfactory advice. The last person to speak said that he was confused more than anything else. While on Dawat he had felt something, but now all that remained was ambivalence. Possibly his nonchalant voice provoked the coordinator to emphasize sternly, quote, "It is not that we go on Dawat for 3 days and then have the rest of the month off." In 2010, I met up with 5 of the Dawatchis I had traveled with the previous year. Adil, who at the time had been struggling with commitment, managed to sideline his doubts. He divorced his wife and married a practicing Muslim from a religious family. Amir Nur Islam similarly continued to be actively involved. But for Ruslan, Rashid and Kanat, it was different. Ruslan had stopped going on Dawat, but emphasized that Dawat had cured his chronic backaches. Rashid was still involved, but no longer maintained the regularity of the previous year. And Kanat had been unable to go on Dawat for the last 4 months. He explained that the worldview of the Tablighis had become too restrictive for him, and I'm quote him at length. "As long as you're inside it, it all makes perfect sense. But from the outside, it looks differently. There are those who give up their jobs, who lose their families. And to be honest, this started to happen to me too. My job suffered as I spent all my energy and time on Dawat. And then one day I came home and found my wife crying. It was her birthday. She had bought tickets for the movies and I had been too busy with Dawat. That's when I decided to shift my focus. I think that there's a time when you need to be actively involved, and then there's a time when you need to find the balance again." End of quote. The logic of the Tablighi method is precisely to ensure that a balance is found between Dawat and everyday life. But for many Dawatchis, this was difficult to achieve. The Dawat experience was so intense because the men felt a release from their everyday commitments. And yet, this was also why it tended to remain a bracketed reality. Finding a balance depended on the strength of the Tablighi network as it continued to exist in between the periods of traveling. Such a network was certainly developing, and Kanat often made a point of helping out his acquaintances from Dawat, for example by making sure that he bought from their stores. But for the moment, the gap between life among Tablighi brothers and... But for the moment, the gap between life among Tablighi brothers and life at home continued to loom large for many of the travelers. And a short concluding section, which I termed pulsation. The Tablighi Jamaat is acutely aware of the need to provide regular boosts of energy lest people's conviction and devotion dissipates. In the movement's literature, this is known as the dry dock parable, in which man is compared to a ship that is constantly being rocked by rough waves that damage the ship and steer it off course. In order to deal with these distracting and troubling worldly forces, Muslims need to have regular access to a space of refuge or dry dock in the form of the mosque or a jamaat, a fellowship, where they can be spiritually nourished and replenished. This pulsating quality of conviction resonated in many stories told by Dawatchis. Nur Islam compared Dawat to food, of which the body always desires more. Quote, "When you go back to the world, you are faced with constant demands. It is always about money. You find yourself sitting at a table, not wanting to listen anymore." It was for this reason, he said, that he avoided to speak about non-religious topics during Dawat. For Maqsad, it seemed quite similar when he said, quote, "You know, this feels like a holiday. Just being here. No problems. No stress." Being on Dawat provided a boost of energy, a place of withdrawal from everyday difficulties, and a space to fantasize about different realities. The intense experience and the constant circulation of stories created an atmosphere in which one was able to come closer to Allah and in which signs of God's presence became more credible. However, we have seen that the elation can dissipate quickly. As a former Dawatchi told me, "When you're on Dawat, everything makes perfect sense, but afterward it appears too simplistic. The logic that is so powerful when part of a fellowship looks different when the social surrounding is made up of people who are not connected to the Tablighis. The immediate and the longer-lasting effects of the Dawat experience dependent on the temporal and social context in which they unfold, as illustrated by the comments of Kyrgyz and Pakistani Dawatchis about each other during a joint Dawat. The differences between them were a frequent topic of conversation, with the Kyrgyz saying that the most significant difference was that the Pakistani had been born and raised in Islam. They admired the Pakistani for their certainty and their stability in matters of faith, and they complained about their own difficulties of having grown up during atheist times and to be living in a largely secular society. By contrast, the Pakistani expressed amazement about the intensity with which Kyrgyz were able to live their faith, and they repeatedly commented on their fervor and energy. What we seem to have here, then, are two different modalities of religious experience. For the Pakistani, Islam was part of their habitus, of the world with which they had been familiar since their youth. To them, Dawat was important to sustain their commitment and to ensure that their belief would not turn into indifference. For the Kyrgyz, Dawat was about something different. It was about overcoming doubt, and hence the cycles of believing and disbelieving which were much more intense. Interestingly, the pattern could be observed not only among individual Dawatchis, but with reference to the Tablighi movement in Kyrgyzstan more generally. As one Kyrgyz scholar who associates himself with the Tablighi Jamaat told me, quote, in the 2000s, the number of three-day Jamaats traveling in the northern regions on weekends was nearing 1,000. This was the period of highest popularity, reaching levels of fashion. Since then, the numbers have dropped significantly, but now there's more regularity, experience, and legalization of the practice. The trade-off between intensity and regularity, between charisma and routine, are there for everyone to see. The particularities of this trade-off in a post-Soviet context, where Islam returned to the public sphere, helps us to understand both the power and the fragility of conviction. I'll end there.